Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 709.2P0115, certificate number 25974. Ledger Art.
You have a pretty cool and interesting art collection in your home. You and your wife have good taste, and you also know what you like.
Our kids don't like our art.
Oh, really?
That's true.
What do they not like about it?
It's just not to their taste.
What would they prefer? I mean, you have a kind of, you like representational paintings.
We do. You'd think the kids would be into that. Yeah. We have one that's not representational. It's a Korean artist who does kind of a trompe l'oeil thing with different...
I like that one.
It's like mulberry paper that they wrap herbal remedies in, but it's kind of a trompe l'oeil thing, so you can't tell if it's 2D or 3D with like fake shadows on it. I love this artist.
Yeah, you showed me their coffee table book of their art, and we perused it one afternoon.
Yeah, the kids hate it.
Really?
Yeah. And guess what? They don't pay the mortgage.
Yeah, exactly. Do you have any art? I mean, so that's an interesting example. Is that a traditional art form that's been repurposed, or is it was art made out of a practical thing?
He's a contemporary artist, and I think he's using, maybe it's the equivalent of pop art. Maybe that's not so different from a Warhol painting, a Brillo box or something, you know, to repurpose this newsprint kind of stuff as a parchment. Yeah.
Do you have any collection of artifacts? Do you have any Roman coins or anything that's not an antique but is an old art piece?
Is it even legal to own that stuff? I feel like I'm a
Roman coin.
I feel like the government's going to come busting in. Like I had dinosaur skulls.
You may own a Roman coin.
Thank goodness.
Yeah. There are lots of laws about what you can do with things that you find. Yeah. But there's also a global market of them.
I've never actually had the urge to like shop for that kind of stuff. Like, I don't even know what's accessible to middle-class people and what's accessible to the rich and what's accessible to the super rich and what only exists in museums. Maybe because a lot of it is not beautiful. Mm-hmm. You know, it's gotten to the older and more authentic it is, the more likely it is to just look like garbage if you don't know what you're looking at.
Right.
So I'm not like, what would beautify this mantle? I got to have some old shards of pottery. Do you have old historical stuff? What's your oldest thing?
Well, you know, I like that stuff, and you'd be surprised when you go online and search. You're absolutely right that the finest things belong in museums, and then there's like the super rich people that own really fine things that belong in museums.
Because Nicolas Cage is not going to give that dinosaur skull back.
Yeah, there's a, you know, there's art poaching and there's, you know, grave robbing and all that, and there's a market for it. And presumably it's rich people that want some funerary urn on their coffee table. It's all bragging rights, I guess.
Yeah.
Or I'm surely some of those people are overwhelmed by the beauty of the thing. But then
you'd have to have scholarly knowledge, I think, in most cases.
You would, or like such a refined aesthetic sense. I think it's more often that you have a self-assessment of your refined sense. And so, but you know, that's where you get all these counterfeits that end up baffling people, or, you know, or bamboozling people into spending millions of dollars on a thing that isn't a thing.
I mean, if there's enough of those, then 1,000 years hence, nobody's going to have any idea what was actually
real. Is this a Rembrandt, or was it by one of his students, or was it by a guy in New York City in 2000? But for historic artifacts, you know, for hundreds of years, people have been digging things up in just laying in the mud in Rome. And if it's super beautiful, but if it's just another bust of some local, you know, like shop owner, that stuff finds its way onto the open market. And the hardest thing is to authenticate it.
Yeah.
But you could, if you wanted, have a collection of artifacts and archaeological finds for surprisingly little.
Until you've given it away, and now the value is going to skyrocket.
Yeah, I think it's a weird market. You know, it's like the market for Judaica. Some of the incredible pieces of Judaic art are very expensive, but there's a long tail.
But at least there's a big interest group buying out of,
right,
you know, historical and theological interest. I don't know what the equivalent of that is for ancient Rome.
I mean,
mafia dons?
Yeah, maybe. I think into the 1990s or even 2000s, there was a kind of secret market of middle-aged guys who had train sets and World War II artifacts, a lot of them pretty questionable.
Yeah.
And it was only the movie American Beauty that revealed this sordid underbelly.
That movie told us so much about ourselves.
It really did.
And also about Chris Cooper's Nazi collection.
But growing up in Alaska, there was...
That's a phrase we often hear on this show.
Yeah, growing up in Alaska. Have I mentioned that I...
Take a drink every time John says...
grew up in Alaska.
Growing up in Alaska. That's going to be my ringtone. It's going to be you saying, growing up in Alaska. Honey, John's calling.
Just over and over, except a different one each time, like a supercut. Yes. Growing up in Alaska. Alaskan art, and by that, I mean both art made in and about Alaska and the art that's popular among art consumers in Alaska, it is very interested in Native American art specifically, and art made from ivory, bone, baleen, art depicting Alaskan scenes.
That's all you have available.
Well, and
you could drive down to the floor 48 and get oil paint, I guess, but mostly it's just driftwood and ivory,
yeah,
as far as the eye can see.
Well, and I think it's an American regionalism, and this is probably true also in Australia or other places that are, you know, where Europeans had first contact with Aboriginal people. If you go to New Mexico,
yeah,
I bet you the upper middle class white residents of New Mexico all have collections of local baskets and carvings.
The state flag of New Mexico is like an indigenous design, right? Like,
yeah.
Yeah, you're right.
And so in Alaska, and in particular because Alaska was so late to be widely settled by Europeans, and there were so many native groups that remained, if not uncontacted, then at least that persisting in their traditional ways, that there was a lot of art available. And a lot of people who had kind of, if they'd lost the traditions of art making, it was only by a generation or two. You know, the same story in Alaska as all across the Americas, the introduction of Christian and government organizations that tried to eliminate native culture and retrain everybody to be farmers or factory workers or I don't know, you know, to rob them of their language and culture. In Alaska, it didn't have 10 generations. It was still present in the elders. And so it became and this was also, you know, kind of that mid-century period when Alaska became a state. It was also a time in American cultural life where there was a reappraisal of Native American art as a fine art, as a collectible art.
Was there a faddish introduction of Alaskan art the same way that like tiki art became so huge around the time of Hawaii's Vogue, or did Hawaii steal all your thunder?
Well, it didn't. It wasn't at all global, you know.
It didn't filter down.
But extremely local to Alaska. It became in a way one of the dominant decorative arts of you know. White settlers, white Americans.
Did it match the settlers' aesthetic also? Because, you know, that's a requirement as well. It can't seem ugly to the newcomer. There has to be something impressive or universal about the local art.
Well, I mean, you know, what you would describe as the naivete of it in terms of subject matter, the fact that it was often on ivory or, you know, local baskets made out of Alaskan material, really acquitted itself with Alaska's self-image as a place both on the last frontier and also a place with abundant natural resources. You know, jade figures highly in Alaskan art, and of course, raw gold nuggets, yeah. Also a big part of the decorative arts there. And one of the reasons that I left Alaska as a young artist was that it's... I ran out of jade. No, there's a...
A musician.
There's a mountain of jade in Alaska called Jade Mountain, and it's literally a mountain made of jade.
You can just go there and chip away all the jade you want.
So much jade.
If you're a resident.
But no, the Alaskan arts are largely... decorative. There's not a ton of abstract art. It's a lot of scenes, right? It's a bear and it's another bear and it's a,
that's true here in our part bears. Of the Northwest as well, that aesthetic of, really kind of boldly stylized animals really kind of matches what people wanted in the 20th century. And it's funny to kind of see it just become a local hotel lobby decor, or even like an NFL logo, basically. Yeah. The Seahawks logo is kind of, you know, this is now the look of the Northwest, is the way these tribes saw the natural world.
Yeah, even in the 90s, I think there were, you know, it was a form of Celtic tattoo that a hipster might get before it was understood that that wasn't kosher.
Yeah.
But also in the Northwest, that was true of a lot of mid-20th century houses, right? Everyone had some form of Native American art, you know, the carved boxes or a cloak or a blanket hanging on the wall.
At the time before concerns about appropriation, it really reflected well on the owner.
Yeah.
Like what an open-minded, well-traveled person you must be. And to someone have this that interest in indigenous art.
Yeah, could speak authoritatively about it. As I talk about my Cowichan sweaters all the time, and those are Native American, Northwest style of clothing made expressly to sell to mid-century Canadians, right? Like, you know, people from Vancouver that came. And so, you know, my interest in them is both from the standpoint of someone growing up in the Northwest who saw that kind of decorative art and thought of it as, yeah, a thing that married you to the region in a way.
Yeah.
You're not going to find those anywhere else. But also I have an affection for that era.
The level of kitsch fades with time.
Right.
You know, at the time there was something kind of tacky and edgy about pop art that today, where, you know, we've seen them go for $10 million at auction. We don't have that anymore. We're like, yeah, the Bende dots are beautiful.
That's, yeah, we lose the ironic.
Yeah.
And I don't think there was ever, it was ever ironic to own this kind of art here. It, as you say, it did mark you as a connoisseur. And all of that is just an extension of 100 years before, where, you know, Europeans were literally going into villages and chopping down their totem poles in the middle of the night and stealing their grave reliquaries. And
it was heathenism.
It, yeah. And it was also just like the, like robbing anyone of their cultural heritage. It was part of erasing them.
Less able to fight back. Yeah.
And also, you know, recognition that the, it was a kind of ethnographic era too. In the mid 19th century, ethnography was really all the rage, and traveling the world to Melanesia and Africa and collecting these things, again, under the rubric of science and cultural understanding, but in a very paternalistic, colonialist way.
Yeah.
But in Alaska, every home had some Native American art. And a lot of it was carving, and most of it was done for the city market. It was a way of, you know, it was a way for, you know, for Inupiaq artists to have something to earn an income. So they carved things for you know, their white audience.
Suddenly there's an export.
And yeah, it's, even if it's just you're exporting it in the town.
Yeah.
And there are... There were and are laws in America about, and in particular in Alaska, that prohibit anyone from making art from whale or, you know, ivory, like skulls, all that stuff that would kind of wash up on the shore. That is, you have to be able to prove that you are Native American in order to sell artwork carved from ivory.
This is for more for ecological reasons than cultural ones, I assume.
No, it's part of a retroactive attempt to understand that
the sacredness of the materials.
That, and also just that that, I mean, you can. Let me rephrase that. The law stipulates that you can't misrepresent it as having been native made.
I see.
Right? You can't say, you can't commit fraud or make it in the style of, and you know.
So it's not just the artist's claims. There's actually certain kinds of representation that might be illegal because you're. It's essentially a counterfeit.
Yeah,
once you make it look like that.
Exactly. And in 1990, there was a law, the Indian Arts and Crafts Act, that instituted a penalty of $250,000 and 5 years in prison for a first-time violation of misrepresenting Native American art. Unfortunately, it is a law that is not enforced with very much engagement. Just recently, and I'm talking about this year, an art dealer in Alaska by the name of Lee John Shrenok was prosecuted for 2 decades worth of selling counterfeit art, counterfeit Native American carvings in his shop right in the center of Anchorage. And there's no question, he did it. And the Department of Interior ended up fining, or the U.S. District Court ended up fining him $2,500 and put him on probation.
My guess is he made a little more than that over the years.
Yeah, pretty harsh toke. But within the United States and within the last century and a half, Native American art became a... became an export commodity, with, you know, and by export I mean from the reservation to the nearest town, you know, and you would see it anywhere you went in the United States. There would often be people on the roadside selling baskets or blankets or something, you know, that was a native craft to people on Route 66, you know, mom and dad USA driving across the country in a station wagon. But it actually is that commodification of American art, Native American art, goes all the way back to the 1860s. It was
really,
yeah.
What does that mean? Settlers were already buying and proudly exhibiting Indian art?
It wasn't settlers so much as it was that, you know, the East Coast kind of Smithsonian Institution grade of people that had that again saw it as a sign of their education and their appreciation of the American story and the. And the and in some ways the nobility of the American Indian and the Lost Plains and all this stuff.
Academics and collectors?
Yeah, right. And a lot of it is a product of the period where the Native art, which had always fulfilled an active role in the culture, it wasn't just made frivolously, right? It did like most Aboriginal art, it fulfilled a purpose.
Beautiful, but it's also got to be a basket or a blanket or whatever. Or why are we doing this?
Right. That art was as the plains were like conquered,
plowed.
Yeah, by Western migration. A lot of the raw materials, a lot of the culture this material. The whole framework of the village and the tribe was under siege and was splintering and fragmenting as tribes encountered this, irresistible onslaught.
Yeah, you don't have time for art in a crisis always.
So some of the original art that we, when we look at Native American depictions and those early photographs, we see this, you know, this incredible kind of culture represented by pictographs and by costumes. And it all sort of predates Western expansion, but a lot of it is not pre-contact. You know, it's the introduction of the horse really changed Native American life.
Yeah.
And the horse features prominently in this sort of culture that really was transformed from 1500 to 1800, 300 years where there wasn't a ton of firsthand experience of people on the plains at watching the culture evolve, but, you know, really like utterly different.
I assume not a lot of that pre-contact art even survives, right? Do we have a good sense of what changed?
Very, very little does, because you know it was made of natural material and it had utility, yeah. Right? It was not preserved in a safe deposit box somewhere.
People love finding arrowheads because that's the only thing made of the hardest thing they had.
Right.
Right.
Before the introduction of beads into as a trade item, a lot of the work that we see now as beadwork was actually done with porcupine quills. And quill work and quill weaving, many of the things that we think of as that, you know, the beaded costumes, the all the garments with all these kind of, you know, decorative patterns, that was all done with quill.
With porcupine quills.
Porcupine quills, because quills could... They took dye easily, like native dyes or natural dyes made out of algae and charcoal and, you know, things that you...
Berry juice,
right, and ochre.
Yeah.
Quills took the dye easily. And then quills are just, in and of themselves, great little knitting...
I assume they'd be tools. I didn't realize they were also the medium.
Yeah.
You knit them together?
And it was art and the manufacture of handicrafts, it was very gendered in Native American culture. And the women were responsible for almost all the abstract art, the patterns, the leather work, the bags, the decorative costumes. and men focused on representative art, you know, pictures of successful hunts. And it was very clear that, you know, most art done by men was kind of heroic art, or
the women's art seems to be more useful. Seems like for stuff around the house.
Yeah. And almost all of the stuff that was functional, yeah, in the sense of it being like day-to-day useful, was made by women. And the men's work was more about incredible feats.
Would that have like ritual or ceremonial?
Yeah. And there was another, a fascinating kind of thing that I think it took until the 1830s for people back east to fully understand. There was a what would you call it? Not a craft work, but a
Kraftwerk?
A Kraftwerk. No, it was basically a form of calendar keeping and like representation of the passage of time called the winter count. And what it was and this was kind of universal across like all the tribes of the northern half of North America. It was a hide, you know, often a buffalo hide, mm-hmm, that two times a year, you know, a kind of porcupine quill would be used to represent the passage of a year. And a year was measured from first snowfall to first snowfall the following year.
Oh, interesting. Years could be different lengths.
Well, yeah, right. I mean, when it snowed the first time, that was the beginning of the new year.
They're not interested in astronomical signs of the seasons. What really matters is weather.
Yeah.
That determines.
And then in the summer, there was a marking of the sun dance, which presumably happened around the solstice. So, you know, it was flexible, but I think probably in a time when the climate was, you know, more or less stable, generally stable. Like growing up, I always thought of the first day of winter being the first day it snowed.
There's often local traditions like that here.
Which was like, you know, November 1st-ish.
Seattle used to get warm right after the 4th of July.
Right.
Yeah.
My mom always said that the first day of summer in Seattle was, yeah, it was Bastille Day,
yeah,
or whatever. So these, you know, these winter counts were also kind of the province of men, and you could represent really decades,
yeah,
on a single hide.
That would be a history.
And the person in charge of maintaining the count, then there were glyphs and other symbols along with the markings that would enable you to tell the story of history. So that you could say, oh, well, that was, you know, clearly it was this year that the big storm happened or whatever.
So you could put in stuff about the hunt or the chief or whatever.
Yeah.
They could also appear on there.
And that is actually how those things became sort of interpretable by Western scholars or by East Coast scholars, by the Smithsonian.
Because by the time we got them, the oral traditions that would have undergirded them might be gone or unavailable to us.
Yeah, a guy by the name of Garrick Mallory realized that there had been a Leonid meteor shower in 1833, and all of these winter counts
from all across the continent.
Yeah, represented it as the year the stars fell, and so he could then take a look at these winter counts, which, you know, started always probably in a different year. Yeah. And
whenever the last hide was full.
Yeah. And line them up and say, oh, now we can see and we can compare the stories to the oral stories of the tribe and see, you know, how the winter count
put actual dates by our reckoning onto these stories.
Right. Yeah. So most of the, you know, most of the quill work persisted, you know, past the introduction of beads, but, you know, beads gradually overtook quill work. But the lion's share of like the useful leather work, what were called the parfletches,
parfletches?
Yeah, a parfletch is like a saddlebag or a lot of the a lot of the luggage, I guess, for lack of a better term, was in the form of hide pouches made in the shape of like an envelope that were made out of elk or most commonly buffalo. And, you know, the hides were tanned. They were often tanned with a kind of, like a prickly pear cactus, pomade, you know, some kind of mush that would scour and make a form of parchment, right? But thicker.
So then you could do decorations on top of that.
You could do decorations on top of it, quill work originally and later beadwork. But they were, you know, they had geometric patterns and they were used to carry food and seed and you know, any household goods as you move nomadically.
Yeah. I guess smaller portable luggage is more important to a nomadic society. You want lots of little pouches.
And you're making teepees.
Not a big roller bag.
There are leggings to use in horsemanship. There are shields that were used in battle.
Yeah.
And all this stuff was pretty ornately decorated and made out of buffalo largely. And we're talking about tribes kind of across the plains and on both sides, right? The Cheyenne, the Blackfoot, the Arapaho, the Sioux, the Mohawk, like everyone here has a tradition of this kind of handiwork.
It's interesting because, mm-hmm. you know, it doesn't make
the Comanche.
Doesn't make your jerky bag any better if it's got cool diamonds on it. But, you know, despite having what we would imagine to be kind of a subsistence level lifestyle, they wanted beautiful jerky bags.
Well, and one of the things that we can't know is how much the geometric patterns also were significant.
Like functional, like that's how you tell what's in the bag.
Yeah, or what or who the people are yeah. that are carrying, yeah. right? And I think that a lot of the battle stuff, the shields and so forth, were decorated by men in ways to indicate their prowess in battle. But the work that the women were doing, you know, some of that didn't, I'm sure a lot of the symbolism of it didn't make it into the ethnographic record. I mean, it took us a long time to understand what was happening with wampum, what it actually, how detailed it was in its ability to tell stories. And I think we still don't fully understand the knotted rope languages of Central and South America.
Inca stuff, yeah. yeah.
But then disaster befell the people of the plains in the form of the wholesale slaughter of the buffalo. And then, of course, the other many disasters that befell the residents of the plains, including
relocation and disease and
destruction, right? Murder.
But the actual, the food source went first, right?
Well, the food source, and it was also the main raw material. All of this stuff was made out of buffalo hide and, you know, and in the old days, porcupine, but also elk and deer. I mean,
our people use every part of the porcupine.
these animals were all being decimated. And in fact, in 1874, the last free herd of buffalo was finally destroyed, and it prompted a war with some of the tribes called the Red River War, where at the end of the war, and the buffalo, spoiler alert, the free buffalo did not survive the Red River War, but some of the a lot of the surviving warriors were then captured and sent to prison in Florida, a common place. You know, like a lot of those prisons were back east.
It's funny to imagine a time when
re-education camps.
Buffaloes were just pests. You know, the bison were getting in the way of fencing off ranch land. So you gotta take care of those like termites.
Well, and it's arguable that in a lot of cases, it was a military campaign to deprive the tribes of food.
It was a war tactic.
But what happened was a combination in the period between the Civil War and the 1880s, where the buffalo were decimated, the tribes were decimated and in many cases confined, both to prisons and to reservations. And a lot of the, and there began a new movement of assimilation that was based in a lot of like what Enlightenment premises about what the future of the Native American tribes was going to be in the United States, right? There was not necessarily a genocidal impulse on the part of everyone in, you know, back east. There was a lot of sense of...
But even the benevolent impulse would be like...
completely assimilationist.
We have to educate them and make them white Christian Americans, basically.
One of the people that figures in our story, General Richard Henry Pratt, famously said, "We must kill the Indian to make the man."
That's the enlightened, the only good Indian is a dead Indian?
No, he meant kill the
Indian
ways.
But right? I like it. The metaphor is still murder of Indians, even to be the nice one.
Yeah,
you know?
And he was in some ways like, well, yeah, we'll see. He comes along.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
In that period where the Native Americans were still largely practicing their old ways, but were finding there were no more buffalo, there was no more range, there was the dawn of a new art form. And at first, it was the result of, you know, in the aftermath of a violent encounter with some, you know, cavalry guys or somebody manning an outpost, a general store somewhere out on the plains. One of the items of raid booty, if a tribe were to attack a wagon train and, you know, and kill everyone and take what was left behind, was paper. For the first time, exposure to this new material, paper.
Of all the things that they were seeing from European settlers, they were into paper.
Well, no, they took it all, right? The guns and the food and the knives.
Right, but it's interesting. I never would have thought of paper as making the cut.
Well, and right, paper would be maybe not as astonishing as steel, but if you were a pictographic culture, if drawing and making art was essential to the way you communicate
it. And the hides are scarce.
And there are no more hides.
And I guess other places you would think of indigenous art as appearing in, you know, caves and you know, rock faces. But on a flat prairie, there's not a lot of natural canvas either, right?
Well, and a lot of the utility of that stuff was that it was mobile. You know, as you move,
right,
you bring the winter count with you. Bring the material with you. And so paper was light, and you had whole volumes of it, and also pencils and crayons, writing implements that were, that were kind of pre-made, charcoals. And a lot of that paper was in the form of ledger books. It wasn't typically...
Oh, yeah, they weren't transporting blank typing paper across the plains.
Yeah, it was, you know...
It was coming because it had stuff on it.
Maybe somebody had a diary, but a lot of these forts, you know, they were keeping inventory. That's what the army does. That's what white people do.
Accounting.
Keep your accounts.
And the Indians, the native tribes took the accounting paper?
So here were these ledger books, some of them, you know, large, full of paper that also were lined and frequently written upon with quill pens, saying like, well, this day we received 40 bags of grain.
This much salt pork.
Yeah, exactly. And so here was this paper that the tribes, in absence of buffalo hides, started to use as record books of their exploits.
So it became their ledger as well.
That's right.
It was a ledger when the cavalry had it, and then it became a ledger again when it got reused.
And it turned out, and a lot of the art of this period that we still have, that we still know about, is art done in these ledger books from this time, because the ledgers often have dates in them.
So you can tell when it got taken.
And one of the things that was learned was that drawing these scenes, and it was typically men that were doing this work now, right? This was not abstract work.
It's analogous to.
Yeah, this is stories, right? Stories of battles, also often stories of encounter with the army and settlers. So depictions of what were known battles, but from the Indian standpoint.
Yeah.
And the drawings themselves were collaborative. So many different people would work on similar stories. You had artists that were really good at drawing horses and artists that were really good at drawing faces.
That's interesting that a modern day scholar could look and be like, we don't know this guy's name, but he clearly drew the horses here, here, and here. And this other guy is not as good. And he drew the other horse.
Yeah. We often do know the artist's name.
Oh, interesting.
Because,
how?
Well, they had glyphs and that represented themselves. And also they were this period, in particular, the young braves, you know, they survived often until the 20th century. If they were born in 1860 and they were doing some of this work in 1880, you know, a lot of them lived to 1950s.
So by the time the ethnographer came knocking, he was still around.
Yeah. I mean, there was a man named Bear with Feathers who was really good at drawing people. And, you know, like White Bird or Red Lance would draw the horse. And then Bear with Feathers would come in and draw the people.
It's great that they got kind of rediscovered by name, you know, the way that later happened with people rediscovering, you know, illustrators they liked or poster artists or, you know, Disney comics artists or, you know, all these kind of other niches where eventually the anonymous author came out.
Yeah. And it's kind of hard. It's hard to grasp the full breadth of this period of encounter with Europeans, because we think about it as being an experience that the Native Americans were having almost exclusively with the army as the sharp point of the spear of this like inexorable wave of settlers that were just coming to take. But there's also the East Coast European intellectual crowd that's trying to, you know, that's Christianizing, but also this is the era of science. So you have the first anthropologists, the first ethnologists, the first, I mean, on one hand,
people wanting them to play something on a drum for them. And
you've got phrenologists over here, but you also have quite a few enlightened thinkers. But often enlightened thinkers bound by the customs of their day. And, you know, this character, General Richard Henry Pratt, he's credited with the first use of the word racism. He coined the word racism as a way of indicting the U.S.
He wasn't endorsing it?
No, he was.
He wasn't like, you know what I'm into.
He was protesting what he considered to be like discrimination against the Native Americans on the basis of their race. And
he was still army and he called this out?
Well, he became, you know, and here's the problem, right? His version of it was the same as Thomas Jefferson's, which was the goal of this encounter is to settle Native Americans.
Civilize.
And turn them into farmers and teach them, you know, I don't know, how to build cars. And so he started what became the Carlisle School in Pennsylvania and then became a series of Carlisle schools, which were, and the Carlisle schools were the classic institution of, you know, forced assimilation. Like
these are the places that always turn out to have cemeteries out back.
Well, or, and definitely the ones that, that say like, yeah, you're no longer allowed to speak your language or practice your
speak English now. You don't see your family anymore.
But there was a recognition that this artwork, and in particular the artwork that went in that, you know, they were discovering these ledgers and they became fetish items. Like, oh my God, look at this. This is an incredible
among the white scholars working with the
treads. When they were discovered. And this is only in a decade or two after they were being made for the first time. The Smithsonian Institution was, you know, like very acquisitive of it and a lot of native handicrafts. If you look in the Smithsonian today, I'm sure they have a much more culturally sensitive display of those items. But in the back, behind the curtain, you're going to find that they were Teddy Roosevelting, you know, they were at the time collecting all, as much of this art as they could. And with, from their perspective, right, an intention that wasn't to erase, an intention.
We're doing the obvious. We're the opposite. We're preserving.
We're preserving. That's right. And it's the, you know, it's the British took the Elgin marbles, right? Because the Greeks couldn't be trusted with them. Yeah. It's this feeling that like, oh, you don't recognize how beautiful your saddlebags are. And the argument like, well, those are our saddlebags. If you take them, we have no way to carry our stuff.
And the Smithsonian's like, well, that's silly. You don't have a museum.
And often the East Coast response was, here are some new saddlebags that say, you know, U.S. government provided saddlebag. So a group of artists, young braves that were part of, that were, you know, captured as part of the Red River War, it was discovered in their captivity that they were using whatever kind of found material they could and doing art.
In some kind of army prison?
Yeah. And so the sort of Richard Henry Pratt model was, hey, wait, well, let's give them art supplies. And so they were provided with ledger books and ink pens.
Did they mock up like used looking ledger books? So this is just what you'd have on the plains if you burn down a settlement.
Yeah, they were encouraged in doing this work. And there was a group in the late part of the, well, I guess you would say the early part of the 20th century called the Kiowa Six, who were all young people forced to attend St. Patrick's Mission School in Oklahoma. And, you know, a professor from the University of Oklahoma art department came out there and said, you know, hey, there were two competing schools, right? There were the art department people that were like, let's give them no art instruction and let them draw what they learned from their families. And then that will be the,
we can see the authentic native art. Yeah.
And then there was the other school, which was like, well, let's teach perspective and teach, you know, I guess modernism and see what that art is. All of it made with the idea of it being a new way for Native Americans to enter into a capitalist economy. And Oscar Jacobson actually took the art of the Kiowa Six to the first international art exhibition in Prague in 1926, which was a huge hit.
Oh man, Europeans of that era loved the people of the plains.
Even
man.
Now, you know, even yeah. now, Europeans love it.
Love their Westerns.
And so the Kiowa Six, they ended up in the 30s. Their artwork was taken to the Venice. Their artwork was taken to the Venice Biennale, and again, massive hit. And that began a kind of international art market for traditional Native American art that was now being made by the next generation that had in some ways been forcibly, in many ways, forcibly deprived of their culture. And this was like a last bit of culture that had been imparted to them by their grandfathers.
I mean, all ledger art, when you think of it, is immediately identifiable as kind of a fusion between the two cultures. You know, you could, right. The fact that it's, you know, written on the back of cavalry or Interior Department notepaper or whatever it is really says this is a record of the encounter. And, you know, if you know more about it, this is what got produced when the actual materials were no longer available due to the ongoing travails of the indigenous people.
Right. It's intrinsically located in time and place, and it can only really...
It's about the crossover between the two cultures.
That's right. In that, it, and because in the first ledger art was done on ledger paper that was discovered as a part of a raid or a part of a, you know, a clash. And then when the army and the ministers and the next wave and Smithsonian guys with a pince-nez arrived, they were like, oh, we have more ledgers here. Is this a thing you want? Like, and particularly as they were being increasingly confined on reservations and in jails.
Hey guys, we didn't actually want the ledgers. We were having to use the...
Yeah, right. What we wanted was the buffalo.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Well, are you like me? Did you come from a childhood where actual drawing paper was scarce?
Yeah.
Like, do you remember?
My mom worked in computers, so we had the dot matrix printer, you know, reams.
Yes.
Where, you know, you could...
With the perforated edges?
Yeah, well, and all the pages were connected, so you could unfold it and do a seven...
You
could
do the Bayou Tapestry.
Yeah, that's right.
We literally made ledger art because my grandpa was sold pet supplies. He was a traveling salesman. And so he had a ton of just accounting...
Yeah.
You know, all the drawing paper at Grandma and Grandpa's house was just accounting stuff where there was blank on the back. Is that what the Native Americans were largely doing, using the unprinted side?
No, they were drawing right over the top of people's accounting, because the accounting paper was accounting on both sides.
Plus, it's noise to them, not signal.
Yeah, that's right.
It would be distracting to us, but they just see squiggles.
So it's fascinating. You can see also the ledger.
Yeah.
Underneath the painting.
Well, that's all my childhood art also has, pet food sales.
Well, and there's, you know, there are other cultures that use ledger art, including the Mennonites, because there's just, you're out there on the plains and you're just repurposing the materials you have, right?
I mean, if you're in a flat grassy space and you have a ledger, is it a heath ledger?
If you go on eBay right now and you search for ledger art, and when we'll get to this in a second, if you search for ledger art and you put the, you say price plus shipping highest rather than ending soonest or newly listed, the first two pieces of art you'll find are paintings about Heath Ledger.
Is he the Joker?
As the Joker.
In both of them? So you just get Joker memes now if you search for ledger art?
Joker memes, and then...
This is what NFTs have done to our culture.
Pretty quickly, you'll find some Native American art, and then we'll go back into Heath Ledger art for a long way. I didn't mention this wonderful artist whose name is... His Native American name was His Fight.
His Fight.
But he was called Jaw by a white friend, and that was kind of how he was known.
Wow.
It's
better if it's a Jamaican friend calling you Jaw.
Calling you Jaw.
But I'll settle for
a Rastafari. He was born in 1850 and he lived all the way to 1924. He was a Lakota, and he had actually been at Little Bighorn.
Wow.
So he did ledger art
history is written by the winners.
Yeah. he did a Little Bighorn ledger art.
Yeah.
You know, he had... he had real bona fides, and he was a very prolific artist. Well, So we entered in the middle part of the century where most of the ledger artists passed away. Unfortunately, a lot of the, the lion's share of the Kiowa Six, like maybe five of the six, died of tuberculosis in another wave of disease, and died young of tuberculosis. One of the Kiowa Six was a woman, Lois Smoky, and she made the fewest number of paintings because she switched to beadwork at a certain point as she got older as her craft. And her paintings actually have they're the rarest and most expensive.
Because they're the scarcest.
And I don't think she died of tuberculosis. In 1985, in Amadon, North Dakota, somebody was going through the boxes in the back of the courthouse, and they found a ledger, a full ledger from 1885, now known as the Amadon Ledger, that had 107 drawings, 87 of which were by his fight. And
am I picturing something chronological, like the Bayeux Tapestry or like a comic strip where often, you know, you'll see time advance across the ledger?
So there's a very,
if it's this big,
there's a very different, typically the ledger paintings they represent scenes, and it isn't necessarily chronological. And even in the scene, things like motion, depth, and time are represented very individually by different artists. Like you'll see sometimes like a horse in motion, its progress across the scene will be represented by hoof prints kind of floating in the air. There are a lot of attempts to show action.
But there's not like a common lexicon.
Not really. It varies, you know, from tribe to tribe or from artist to artist. And so, and like a lot of, you know, what you would think of as Aboriginal art, it's like perspective and depth and time are represented in ways that aren't, that's not
linear Western.
Not linear,
typical,
right.
Typical, yeah.
And as the encounter got deeper, as there was more Western education and more, I'm sure, people at a train depot saying, hey, you know, White Bear, if you put this over there, then it looks like it's further behind, you know, just a little, like you see the evolution.
Yeah.
But the discovery of the Amadon Ledger kind of like excited a new, or, you know, there was a new understanding of these as important artifacts, ledger art not just an artifact, but a crucial part of the American story. And also during this period, in the 80s, a real art world covet item.
Oh, so it becomes a shopping spree?
And so the ledger got taken apart, and the context of, you know, whether or not the stories were arranged linearly, they did have context, right, taken together.
Yeah.
The drawings were spread far and wide, sold at auction, you know, put in frames, became decorative art on the walls of Taos, New Mexico millionaires. And so it was kind of a run on the bank of ledger art, which starting then and to this day became, fine art, Native American, but Old West sort of fine art.
But it's kind of a bummer that it immediately gets dismantled.
Yeah, a real bummer. And again, it's the conflict between the Smithsonian Institution model, which increasingly realized that
it's a text, keep the corpus together.
That's right. And this is an artifact. This belongs in a museum. And whoever found it in the North Dakota courthouse and realized, oh, I could make, you know.
How many customers can I? Yeah.
Yeah. But what it also did was reignited within the tribes themselves an understanding that this was an art form that was a way to kind of reconcile their own post-encounter culture with traditional ways. You know, it's a struggle, I think, among Native American artists that they don't want to try and duplicate pre-contact art because that feels as illegitimate to their own experience as it would.
It's pastiche.
Yeah.
It'd be like me trying to write a Victorian novel.
Right. If I'm a Sioux growing up on a reservation somewhere, I've never seen wild buffalo either. Yeah. And so you see a lot of Native American artists really wrestling with modernity as a thing they want to include in art based on their experience, but also to incorporate, you know, traditional elements. And so starting in the 60s, but then really ignited in the 80s, there was a new generation of artists that began to make new ledger art. And one of the things that made it interesting was that a lot of artists discovered that you can buy ledgers from 1880 all day.
Oh, there's still period ledgers around.
If you go on eBay right now and Google, you know, like 1800s ledgers.
Because some flour mill kept the room full of everything.
Probably within 10 miles of where we're sitting. I mean, I know in my own library, I have books that were, you know, diaries and whatnot kept by my people in the 1880s that are like, yeah, they're just recording like
just shopping lists.
Crop yields. Yeah. It's not. And so anyway, you can find even now big ledgers. Some of them that were never written in, but a lot of them, you know, they have that kind of fading ink and it's just, you know, it's an elegant cursive. But a lot of the contemporary artists actually find these old ledgers as a kind of raw material and they're not misrepresenting the work they're doing now.
It's not a counterfeit.
No, they're not selling it as something from 1860. It's
forgery.
It's not like going back and finding some, you know, old vellum and erasing.
Which people do. They'll find old paper to sell their fake manuscript.
This is a new kind of pastiche form. And they incorporate a lot, you know, and you can find artists now working in many different media, photographs and painting and collage, and using ledger art as a jumping off point. And it continues to be kind of relevant in terms of, you know, the conversation, because in a way you're portraying a kind of ghost culture that you're relearning as a part of the kind of 20th century, like reevaluate, or, you know, an attempt to recapture the dying languages, the culture that's lost, a reappreciation or a new appreciation for what had formerly kind of been dismissed as like grandmother who's sitting over here.
I like the reversal of the conflict and the erasure also by like using the white document as kind of the thing that gets overwritten.
Right.
You know, this fades into the background and what becomes prominent is our tribal and cultural symbols.
Sure, isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
One of the kind of early people in this new format. Oh, and so this is the other interesting thing. As ledger art has become a modern art form, now it is practiced equally by women and men in the tribes.
For the first time.
Yeah. So there are a lot of the prominent ledger artists are women in the tribes. And one of the early ones was a woman by the name of Marcel Harjo, who is... she's from Oklahoma and she's a Kiowa. And in 1965, she was Miss Indian America.
Like it's a beauty pageant?
Yeah.
For Native American women?
Yeah.
Do they still have Miss Indian America?
I'm not sure if they do. But she is, you know, she became a pretty prominent and kind of wonderful painter. And, you know, her art is available for sale. And a lot of this feels like it should be prohibitively expensive, but of course this is an unknown,
you can still get on the ground floor of this, unlike most other art forms.
Yeah. She's, you know, still alive and still painting and, you know, for $1,000 or, you know, a lot of this art is between 1,000 and, or in some cases even less, to, you know, between 1,000 and 10,000. One of the most prominent ledger artists working today is a man named Harvey Pratt, who in this same period of time was, he joined the Oklahoma Police in 1965, and he became a famous forensic artist who pioneered a technique of taking autopsy photos of victims of crime, many of whom had, you know, where the corpse had decayed, and he could reconstruct their face in a technique he called soft tissue reconstruction. He could then draw, you know, an artist rendition of the victim, and then that would be the thing that the police would use to, you know, to search for the identity of the victim. And he became a national forensic artist. He worked on Green River Killer and Bundy and all these things.
Oh, wow.
Doing these artworks.
Reconstructions of the victims.
And he ended up a director. He ended up teaching this technique to other forensic artists. And then at a certain point in retirement, he decided to start doing ledger art. And, you know, he also was pretty famous in the Bigfoot community for doing Bigfoot art about,
I guess that's where the money is.
Well, people would describe their Bigfoot encounters and he would do like a
he's like a police artist of Bigfoot.
Yeah, police artist of Bigfoot. So there are a lot of his Bigfoot works out there. But he very famously then became a ledger artist, and his ledger art is extraordinary and also available for sale.
I feel like I could contribute to ledger art by, like not the actual art itself. That would be, I don't have the talent and it would be a terrible look, but, I feel like I could just make some ledgers. Yeah. Like if there are any great native artists out there who are like, we need kind of a nerdy white man to make us some good ledgers that we could then put some good heroic deeds on. Like, I feel like I would be happy to sit and make the ledgers for them.
You could just turn our omnibus notes sideways and paint over them, and they'd be even more interesting.
We send out omnibus notes as perks for Patreon subscribers. We autograph them and send them on. But yeah, I would love to see somebody just
paint over them. We have some great artists that are fans of the show. Maybe we should send them some omnibus notes and have them paint over them. I learned about ledger art because I have a friend who, and I was in their office the other day, my friend Nate, and he had this wonderful, very large piece of Native American art on the wall. And as I looked at it closely, I saw that it was painted over a ledger from the 1860s. And the leather, you know, the ledger says at the top, like, U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, Indian Board, ledger of, you know, so it has a, you know, an embossed letterhead.
What is this?
And I said, what am I looking at? You know? And he said, oh, it's a contemporary artist by the name of Terence Gardapie. And he became aware of ledger art at some point in his own life and was like, you know, I love, it's just, it's so evocative.
There's probably more post-ledger art now than there was actual period ledger.
I mean, and actual ledger art is now a museum quality thing to find.
To be an eccentric billionaire.
Now. Yeah, it's very expensive, and it's very, you know, in a way, somewhat questionable that you would have it.
Right.
Especially, you know, given these situations where, like, a book was
split up.
Yeah, split like up.
Desecrated, and, maybe.
But it is, you know, it is something that that's available to people now as a revisionist art form, but in a kind of positive way, like a reimagining.
And that concludes Ledger Art, entry 709.2P0115. Certificate number 25974 in the omnibus. Now, the boring accounting of our time is social media posting. If you would like to paint over John's and my social media posts in your far distant era, you can find them archived at The Omnibus Project.
Print them out, paint over them.
At Ken Jennings, at John Roderick. I mean, that's really, it's going to be better than NFTs. Just print out a tweet and do some watercolors. You don't want, he doesn't need to be a monkey wearing sunglasses.
Print out a tweet, paint over it.
This is what Mr. Rogers sings as he's doing it in heaven. you could email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. And then you could, of course, print that out and paint your heroic deeds on top of it.
Right. You can support the show and we will send you our notes and you can paint over them. And then what? Sell them? Send them back? If they sell them, would that be...
appropriation?
Yeah.
That's not a cultural good. There's no shortage of slapdash podcast notes by middle-aged white people.
Are you sure, though?
I think. I don't know.
Do other people...
Is it Welsh art?
There you go. Part of the Welsh diaspora? No, I just wonder if other podcasts are quite as slapdash as we are. I think it's our slapdashness that sets us apart.
If you want to send over your grandpa's accounting ledgers for us to paint on, you can send that to the Omnibus Project, P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. We just got, what did we get today? Oh, a Christmas card from the Donahues. Thank you.
Thanks, Donahues.
The Donahues. It appears they have posted with their kids maybe inside a claw machine.
Whoa. You know, everybody, correct me if I'm wrong. Was this true? I used to imagine a situation where I had a room full of pillows. Did you imagine a room full of pillows? As a kind of thing that if you were rich one day, I'm talking about as a kid, if you were rich one day, would you get a room full of pillows?
I did blanket forts, and I think I was aware that ballrooms were like a cool thing at places my family would never pay to take us to.
They didn't have those when I was a kid.
But I never thought of the pillow thing.
I was so into a room full of pillows as an idea, and I was talking to my daughter the other day, and she was like, showing me her design for the house she was going to build when she was grown up.
Yeah.
And it had a room full of pillows. And I was like, room full of pillows?
There must be a chromosome.
Where did you hear about this? And she was like, well, duh, it's so obvious. If you could, wouldn't you have a room full of pillows?
It's just proof that American kids like to be in bed.
Yes. American grown-ups too.
Oh, this is nice. Matthew sent us a copy of his new book called North American Maps for Curious Minds.
Oh, that's for us.
And it looks like it's very much in the... It kind of seems like even the packaging and the trade dress is kind of designed to look like a Gen X era children's book or textbook.
Let me see.
But the maps inside are very much internet era.
Hold it up. Stop hiding it behind your Dell computer.
And they are very cool.
That's cool.
Here's a map of things that fall on New Year's Eve in North America, whether it's... a Pac-Man, a pineapple, or a possum.
Or my uncle.
Here's a map of Groundhog Day predictions. Here's a map of U.S. states by their highest paid public employee.
Oh, this is cool.
Which is almost always, you know who the highest paid...
It's a sports person from the college.
It's almost always the football coach, yes. These are great maps. Oh, the first country you will reach if you swim west or east from various points.
Okay.
Do you know what, if you swim due west from Seattle, do you know what country you hit?
Russia.
That is correct.
It's Kamchatka.
It's Russia almost everywhere from, what is that, the Strait of Georgia down to roughly Grants Pass.
Uh-huh. And then after that, is it Japan?
It's Japan, then all the way almost to Baja.
What? It's Japan?
Isn't that crazy?
Because I guess it's such a... It's
a long archipelago, baby.
And then at Baja, what happens?
There's a short gap of where you hit Taiwan... and then there's a series of stripes where you'll hit Hawaii or the Philippines. This map is now one of the most... Just check that out.
Give me that.
So thank you, Matt. Check out his North American Maps for Curious Minds.
Wow, that's so cool.
That is pretty cool.
It's so weird that on the East Coast, Scotland is so high up. It's like Hudson Bay high.
Yeah, there's no way to hit Scotland.
And even Wales is super up in Newfoundland.
Like Maine is like
France,
Morocco.
Like southern France, right? And then Vermont and New Hampshire is Spain. And Portugal goes all the way to Virginia Beach. Wow. And then it's Algeria starts in north. North Carolina.
It also shows the kind of the America centrism of not realizing how large small foreign countries are compared to large U.S. states.
Yeah. So crazy. Look at that.
Thank you, Matthew. You could also find your fellow futurelings talking about things even weirder than this by looking for their fora on Facebook and Reddit and Discord and whatnot. And do give to the Patreon. It keeps the show going. Patreon.com/omnibusproject is where you should go right now if you think, let's say you've caught up on Omnibus. You wish you had 15 to 20, no, how many new shows? 15 to 20 new shows.
Yeah.
Would be available to you right now if you donated to the Patreon because we do
20 at least.
It's 20. We do a monthly addenda show.
Yeah.
And we've now been doing it for well over a year.
Yeah. And the addenda shows are great. They're fun. A lot of people write in and tell us that we were wrong or that we were right, but actually. And then Ken just shoots them down one after another.
And we never get letters from people who are like, I don't listen to the addenda shows, and that's working out great for me. Nope. I'm a happy, fulfilled person not having heard them.
Nope. The letters pour in from addenda listeners, and they're always extremely complimentary of me and my shows.
If you're a completist who's wishing you had more Omnibus to listen to, go to patreon.com/omnibusproject. Basically, you could flip a switch and give yourself 20 new shows today.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. Whew! If you can even call it that. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.